It's Monday, November 24th, 2008, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Good day, Stashers. Welcome to the podcast and the beginning of Thanksgiving week here in the United States of America. And to that end, I'd like to remind you all that there will be no daily audio stash for Thursday or Friday of this week. I'll be enjoying the holidays just like the rest of you, and I sure hope you're spending them with someone you love this year. Unfortunately, bad news for the cannabis community isn't taking a break this holiday week. We'll be speaking with Keith Stropp, the legal counsel of Normal, to talk about a breaking decision from the California Supreme Court this morning that will severely impact medical marijuana in the Golden State. And speaking of the Golden State, we bring you part two of our interview with Californian Mike Gray, the screenwriter and author of the book Drug Crazy, about the escalating violence and corruption in the drug war south of the border in Mexico. All that in your regular musical break, so let's load up the protopipe and enjoy your Normal Daily Audio Stash.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our Normal Daily Audio Stash, Hemp Headlines. Breaking news. California Supreme Court deals major blow to dispensaries in Mensch ruling. The California Supreme Court has made its ruling on the appeal of People v. Mensch. According to the court, quote, "The Compassionate Use Act of 1996 provides partial immunity for the possession and cultivation of marijuana to two groups of people, qualified medical marijuana patients and their primary caregivers. We consider here who may qualify as a primary caregiver. We hold that a defendant whose caregiving consisted principally of supplying marijuana and instructing on its use, and who otherwise only sporadically took some patients to medical appointments, cannot qualify as a primary caregiver under the Act and was not entitled to an instruction on the primary caregiver affirmative defense." Now, later on, we're speaking with Normal's legal counsel, Keith Straub, about this ruling, but let me give you a few more excerpts from this Mensch ruling so you can understand the background. The court said, quote, "We conclude a defendant asserting primary caregiver status must prove at a minimum that he or she, one, consistently provided caregiving, two, independent of any assistance in taking medical marijuana, and three, at or before the time he or she assumed responsibility for assisting with medical marijuana. What is not permitted is for an individual to establish an after-the-fact caregiving relationship in an effort to thereby immunize from prosecution previous cultivation or possession for sale. A primary caregiver must establish he or she satisfies the responsibility clause based on evidence independent of the administration of medical marijuana. Under the Act, a primary caregiver relationship is a necessary antecedent, a predicate for being permitted under state law to possess or cultivate medical marijuana. The possession or cultivation of marijuana for medical purposes cannot serve as the basis for making lawful the possession or cultivation of marijuana for medical purposes. To conclude otherwise would rest the primary caregiver defense on an entirely circular footing. The trial court accurately assessed the law when, in denying Mensch's request for primary caregiver instruction, it explained, quote, I'm satisfied that simply providing marijuana in and of itself to these folks does not, you don't bootstrap yourself to becoming the primary caregiver because you're providing marijuana, end quote, and, quote, you have to be a caregiver before you can provide the marijuana, end quote. We have no doubt our interpretation of the statute will pose no obstacle for those bona fide primary caregivers whose ministrations to their patients the Act was actually intended to shield from prosecution. The spouse or domestic partner caring for his or her ailing companion, the child caring for his or her ailing parent, the hospice nurse caring for his or her ailing patient, each can point to the many ways in which they, medical marijuana aside, attend to and assume the responsibility for the core survival needs of their dependents. The Act allows them, insofar as the state criminal law is concerned, to add the provision of marijuana where medically recommended or approved as one more arrow in their caregiving quiver. It simply does not provide similar protection where the provision of marijuana is itself the substance of the relationship. End quote. Hawaii medical pot users up 87% from the Honolulu Advertiser. The number of medical marijuana patients in Hawaii has grown 87% in the past 2 years, with the biggest gains on Maui and the Big Island. According to the State Department of Public Safety, 4,200 patients were registered statewide as of June 30th, with 444 more signing up since then. One reason for the increase is that more doctors have been certifying patients for the program, according to Keith Kamita, head of the department's Narcotics Enforcement Division. Still, a relatively few physicians account for most of the state's medical marijuana patients, he said. One Big Island doctor, for example, accounts for about half of the total certified patients statewide. In fiscal year 2008, patients statewide visited 85 on-island physicians to obtain a qualifying diagnosis for medical marijuana use, compared with 62 physicians in fiscal 2006, according to DPS. Despite the growing use of medical marijuana in Hawaii, access to the drug remains an issue for many patients whose marijuana use is protected by a state law that conflicts with federal and state laws prohibiting any use or distribution of marijuana. State Rep. Joe Bertram III, a Democrat, calls the medical marijuana law a cruel joke because it legalizes medical use of marijuana but fails to provide patients safe, easy access to it. Bertram has held a medical marijuana permit since 2005. During the 2008 legislative session, Bertram proposed creation of a secure growing facility on Maui and expanding the amount of marijuana patients can legally possess, but settled for a bill that would have created a task force to study cultivation and other issues surrounding the medical marijuana law. The bill was opposed by law enforcement officials who object to any expansion of the state's medical marijuana program. Governor Linda Lingle vetoed the measure, calling it, quote, objectionable because it is an exercise aimed at finding ways to circumvent federal law, end quote. As the Mensch case in California and this article from Hawaii so deftly illustrate, The elephant in the room in the 13 medical marijuana states is cannabis supply. 25% of the citizens of the United States live in a state where their personal medical use of cannabis under doctor's recommendation is protected from legal sanction, but they can still be prosecuted for their attempts to get the cannabis to use medically. I think voters, without much knowledge of the issue, just figured, if your granny's smoking a joint for her glaucoma or your nephew's smoking a bong to help him with his chemo, then leave him alone. But they didn't consider that for them to get the medicine for the joint or the bong, somebody had to break a trafficking law at some point. Where do they get that first seed or clone to grow their own? This is the dilemma of medical marijuana. We maintain a criminal prohibition against a plant, but accept some people from that prohibition because of their illness. It's kind of a separate but equal solution for the patients. Their medicine is never truly treated like other medicines. And a government price support for the sellers of medicine. Prohibition endangers the patients by making acquisition of medicine a criminal act and providing profit motive for criminals to acquire patients' medicine through robbery. WHAM founders Valerie and Michael Corral face the loss of their land and the end of a dream. From the Santa Cruz Metro Weekly. Now, Valerie Corral was a guest on our show and spoke about the Women's Alliance for Medical Marijuana, or WHAM, as part of my interviews with Wendy Chapkis and Richard Webb on their book Dying to Get High. Log on to the Stash blog at stash.normal.org, and I've got links for Valerie, and you can go back and hear those interviews if you'd like. Now, Valerie is facing the loss of her home and her land and the WHAM Collective. This is from the article in the News and Culture section. But as of July this past summer, the land that the Corrals called their home for over 20 years is slipping away. Because of a perfect storm of factors, plummeting donations to WHAM, the DEA raid of the property in 2002, death, and taxes, Valerie can no longer afford to stay in her home, and WHAM is losing its iconic garden. I'm exhausted, says Valerie. I'm losing my land, the place I thought that I'd be buried. Though the situation is complex, Ben Rice, an attorney who has represented the Corrals for the last 15 years, blames the situation solely on the federal government. Without the DEA's continual assault on California law, medical marijuana organizations would not be raided, would not spend their savings on legal defense, and would not lose precious donations due to spooked members. Quote, WHAM is sort of the soul of the medical marijuana community, says Rice. This never would have happened if the feds had taken the time to look at what WHAM was about and who Mike and Val were. For them to lose this property, they've given everything they have to WHAM, and this is what they get for it. It's so, so sad, end quote. There is something seriously wrong with this country when a selfless person like Valerie, who at great legal risk to herself, gives her whole life to helping patients, and she's persecuted and bankrupted. But then, the executives of the big three U.S. automakers are each flying a corporate private jet to Washington to ask for taxpayer bailouts when all they've done is act completely selfishly as they've mismanaged Detroit to near bankruptcy.
Hello, Chicago!
Barack Obama has been elected the 44th President of the United States. But will he bring us, the cannabis community,
the change we can believe in?
It's an issue of doctors prescribing medical marijuana. I think that should be appropriate.
Normal is asking you to take action and help us hold President-elect Obama to his word with our $10,000 pro-cannabis law reform ad contest.
When I was a kid, I inhaled frequently. That was the point.
Just make a 30 or 60 second video or flash animation that answers the question, what should President Obama do about pot? You can submit as many entries as you like
and winning videos will be featured on Normal's website and television campaigns.
What I'm not going to be doing is using Justice Department resources to try to circumvent state laws on this issue.
The grand prize is $3,500, so enter early and enter often.
Well, I would not punish doctors if it's prescribed. That may require some changes in federal law.
Contest deadline is January 15, 2009. Check NORML.org for official contest rules.
The war on drugs has been a utter failure, and I think that we need to rethink and decriminalize our marijuana laws.
President Obama, we couldn't agree more. The National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws is the largest grassroots drug law reform organization in America. So every Monday we visit with the activists in drug law reform who are fighting for our freedom. Get motivated to get it regulated. Join us in some political activism today. You can start by visiting NORML.org. Well, we're breaking some news here this holiday week on the Daily Audio Stash, and not a very good Thanksgiving gift for those of us in the cannabis law reform community. The Supreme Court of California has made its ruling in a case called People versus Mensch, and it doesn't look very good for the medical marijuana caregivers in the state of California. But to get an expert opinion on this, we go to Normal's legal counsel, Keith Stropp, the founder of Normal, to discuss this ruling. And Keith, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Russ. It's always nice to be with you.
The primary thing I see here in just the opening paragraphs, they say that they were considering who would qualify as a primary caregiver, and they hold that a defendant whose caregiving consisted principally of supplying marijuana and instructing on its use cannot be qualified as a primary caregiver. What does this mean for the state of medical marijuana in California?
Well, I think it is going to cause a significant change in the manner in which medical marijuana is produced and distributed over a period of time. I mean, this won't happen overnight, of course, but many of the people who thought they were protected from state prosecution as a primary caregiver based that on the fact that the patient who was authorized to use medical marijuana had given them a letter saying, "I designate you as a primary caregiver," and that was it. Most of them have nothing to do with providing care to the patient. They provide medical marijuana for the patient. Under this decision, the state Supreme Court makes two points that there's no way to get around, it seems to me. Number one, simply supplying the medical marijuana or even the knowledge of how to grow the marijuana is not in and of itself sufficient to qualify as a primary caregiver. And secondly, the more traditional concept that most of us have as to who would be a primary caregiver, you know, somebody who helps bathe the person or somebody who does their shopping for them because perhaps they can't get out and do it themselves, that has to be an ongoing relationship before the person begins to supply the medical marijuana for the protection to be applied. So I do think, the other thing that's sort of obvious that comes out of that is for, I think there are literally hundreds, probably thousands of marijuana growers in the state of California who thought they were protected because they grow and supply marijuana to the various patient dispensaries. Under this decision, it is clear, without question, those people are not protected from prosecution. They are simply treated as any other illegal seller of marijuana, so they are at great risk.
So this will be a decision that is going to have effect in California based on how the California laws were written, where they only give two protected classes, the patient and the caregiver. It'd be somewhat different in a place like New Mexico or Oregon, where the laws are written differently. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. In fact, in the decision, they mention at one point the New Mexico language, and I think they mention one other state, it may have been Oregon, in which a caregiver in New Mexico, as I recall, a caregiver is defined as somebody who helps the patient, and I think if you were growing their medical marijuana and that was the only thing you were doing for them, it seems like under the language in the New Mexico statute, you might still be protected from prosecution. But clearly, this is an example where the Prop 215 language, which of course was the first of these state medical use initiatives, the language that was drafted was not drafted quite as carefully as we might have liked as we look back on it now.
Yeah, and just looking at some of the quotes here in the decision, one of the justices writes that the possession or cultivation of marijuana for medical purposes cannot serve as the basis for making lawful the possession of cultivation of marijuana for medical purposes.
That's right. They mention that in a couple of places where apparently the defendant had made a sort of a circular argument. I'm a primary caregiver, and therefore I'm entitled to provide marijuana to these people. And of course, the court was saying, wait a minute, that's the question. Do you qualify as a primary caregiver? If we make that conclusion, then yes, you're protected. But they, of course, did not reach that conclusion in this case. I'll be honest, Russ, I don't think this is a big surprise to most people who are going to read it, certainly not the legal community. It was always a stretch of the plain meaning of the language of the statute to claim that if your only relationship to the patient is that you provide them with medical marijuana, that somehow this is legally protected. I don't think that was ever the intent of the drafters of Prop 215, and it certainly was not the language that they used in the initiative. So I believe this brings the California medical marijuana model back a little closer to the way it was intended to be when it was originally drafted. I don't think it's going to gut the law. I mean, you're still going to have a very strong medical marijuana law in California because, as you recall, in California, they're more generous in terms of the categories of illness for which a doctor can recommend medical marijuana. In many states, they're far more limited for what it can be recommended for. But in this one area, as to who qualifies for a caregiver, this is a significant change, and it's going to cause, I think, a significant change on the ground in California.
Right, and in their conclusion here, the court mentions, you know, that they feel that the statute won't pose an obstacle to bona fide primary caregivers. The quote here is, the act allows them, insofar as state criminal law is concerned, to add the provision of marijuana where medically recommended or approved as one more arrow in their caregiving quiver. So again, it's back to that definition of caregiver, and the idea being that you have to have an ongoing relationship with that patient, and the care has to be something other than just the marijuana.
Well, and in fact, the language is actually in Prop 215. I hadn't gone back and read that myself for a long time, but when I saw it in this decision, I'm trying to find it right now, but it has to do with defines primary caregiver as the individual designated by the person exempted under this section who has consistently assumed responsibility for the housing, health, or safety of that person. Now, clearly, for someone to read that language and claim that it somehow protects someone whose only relationship is that they grew the marijuana that they then provided or sold, in some cases, sold for money to the patients, that's a bit of a stretch to think that that language would have covered them. Now, obviously for the last decade, it's been allowed to cover them in California. But again, this decision has been pending for some time. People knew it was coming down, and I suspect that you're going to see quite a bit of change on the ground in California as to how marijuana is grown and distributed to patients. They're going to have to clean up their act, frankly.
Yeah, well, California doesn't have any sort of grower designation, for
That's
one
correct.
Thing. And I'm wondering, what do you anticipate as far as the changes, as far as law enforcement, how they're going to react to this decision? I know that a lot of those counties in California are very anti-medical marijuana, and I can see this being kind of like their green light to go ahead and start busting more people.
Oh, I think without question, especially dispensaries. I would think the dispensaries are the people most at risk. Now, anybody who grows is going to be at risk, but the dispensaries are so easily identified. You know, some of them have signs out front. They have neon marijuana leaves and things like this. Mm-hmm. And most of them have no relationship to the patients other than they sell them their medical marijuana. But because they were claiming to be somehow protected as a primary caregiver, a lot of state authorities have been willing to kind of lay back and sort of ignore this for the moment. I have a feeling that certainly in counties like San Francisco and stuff, they're going to continue to have dispensaries, and I'm sure the local authorities are going to protect them. But I suspect there are large parts of California where dispensaries will become a thing of the past.
Would this Supreme Court ruling from the California Supreme Court have any effect on how the federal apparatus is going to work with regards to the dispensaries in California?
Well, I don't think it will. it won't have any immediate impact beyond California. On the other hand, we can't delude ourselves here. When you talk about the 13 states that have legalized medical use, there's no doubt that California is the major mover and shaker among them. So if the method for growing and distributing medical marijuana is significantly limited in California, I have to think it will probably have the same kind of an impact in these other states. In other words, there will be kind of a intellectual encouragement to interpret those provisions carefully in the other states. Don't presume that anybody who grows marijuana and a patient says, you're my caregiver, that therefore they can legally grow it. This decision makes it clear, at least in California, that is no longer the law.
Mm. Well, it's a developing story. We'll keep our eye on it for the rest of this holiday week and see how other outlets react to it. We're just starting to get some of the opinions from some of the organizations out there that are fighting for medical marijuana access in the state of California. So this is quite the news day for us to be bringing this up. And we're hoping for something better for the holidays, unfortunately.
Yeah, I noticed that on the brief. I mean, you had Americans for Safe Access and Drug Policy Alliance and, you know, a number of good groups that obviously have the interest of medical use patients at their heart, and they wanted very much to hold on to this Court of Appeals decision, but it'll be interesting to hear their response. I suspect that they knew going in that this was going to be a hard victory to hold on to.
Mm. Keith Stopp is the founder of Normal and the legal counsel for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, speaking to us from Washington, D.C., and thanks for joining us, and have yourself a great holiday weekend.
Thank you. Same to you, Russ.
Thanks, Keith.
Are you or is someone you know a marijuana smoker? Have you or is someone in your family been arrested for a marijuana violation? You need to know the truth about pot. Normal, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, is the most comprehensive source of information regarding marijuana and its effects on health as well as legal issues. Normal even offers a database of lawyers specializing in cannabis in your area. Normal, the nation's largest and most successful marijuana law reform organization, has spent decades gathering the knowledge and science on everything related to cannabis. Normal is the best resource to find out the truth about marijuana, connect with a lawyer in your area, or help find an end to prohibition. Information is available at normal.org, that's N-O-R-M-L.org, or toll free at 888-67-NORMAL.
Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org.
Happy Monday, Stashers. Today's music is a long, windy jazz song that I wasn't sure if I wanted to include on the Stash, since it, like many great jazz songs, is long. 7 minutes long, to be exact. But on the other hand, it's called the Unabonger. And maybe you think that's a typo, but no. If you listen to the song, there's a specific point near the beginning when you can hear them taking bong hits. Typo it is not. Then I thought maybe some of you have had a wild, exciting weekend, and that some of you have had a stressful, economy-stricken weekend. So I'm playing this song to mellow you out on both extremes, to get you back into the swing of things, if you will. Bennett Pastor, pianist, met Gregory Ryan, bassist, in 1993 as faculty members of the Stanford Jazz Workshop. At the same workshop, they met Cuban saxophonist Yosvani Terry Cabrera and percussionist Daphnis Prieto. I hope I'm saying that right. They brought their wildly different styles of music together for this 2001 release. And, of course, you can find out more about this album on the Grupo Yankee website, which is linked at our blog at stash.normal.org. And without any further ado, here is Bennett Pastor and Gregory Ryan with the Unabonger.
Mm-hmm. If I were to tell you that in America, right now, over 1 million children sell marijuana, what would you think? Would you think that any public policy that creates over 1 million teenage marijuana dealers needs to be re-examined and possibly amended? You would not be alone. The members of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, aka NORML, have been working since 1970 to reform marijuana laws such that responsible adults, not children, sell and use marijuana. Isn't it high time to reform America's misguided marijuana laws? This is Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of NORML in Washington, D.C. Only concerned citizens can effectively end the federal government's nearly 70-year-old prohibition on responsible adult marijuana sales and use. Want to know more about how you can help? Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's popular and informative webpage at NORML, NORML.org.
We pick up now with part two of my interview with screenwriter and author of Drug Crazy, Mike Gray, and our discussion of his op-ed piece in the San Diego Union-Tribune discussing the escalation of corruption and violence in the drug war south of the border in Mexico. Now, looking back to the situation in Mexico with the cartels there, a lot of this, these trade routes through Mexico have developed since the U.S. government cracked down on the shipping lanes through the right. Caribbean and so on. What is the primary? Is there a primary a drug of choice here when they're transporting? Is it cocaine? Is it primarily marijuana? Is there any?
Well, the history of the transfer of drug routes to Mexico began during the first Bush administration when the cocaine traffic was coming through the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. It was coming up the island chain, and they were moving it out across the Caribbean and into Miami primarily, and that was the major route for cocaine distribution into the United States. They very effectively cracked down on the Caribbean transportation routes, the airplanes. They got radar down there. They got high-speed boats. They got the Navy deployed. They were all over them, like, you know. So as a consequence, the traffic, of course, never ceases. That's the one thing that everybody overlooks, that you can shift it from one place to another. But the traffic never ceases because the money and the demand
never ceases.
Are unrelenting.
Yeah.
And what they were doing was the Mexicans had been simply facilitators for the Mexican cartels. The Mexicans were moving heroin and cocaine into the United States, and the Colombians were moving cocaine into the United States, but they would bring it to the Mexicans, and the Mexicans would simply take it across the border for them.
Mm.
They would take it across into the U.S. because they had family on the other side, and the Mexicans, let's face it, the Mexicans have been successful in smuggling entire human beings across the border pretty much on an hourly basis.
Right.
they got whole people coming across the border, so it was no trick to put a backpack on some of them and say, here, carry this, and we'll pay you when you get here.
Yeah.
So suddenly, one day, we managed to do another stupid thing. We put financial pressure on the Colombian drug cartels and managed to really squeeze them so they couldn't pay the Mexicans what they were used to getting in cash to transfer the drugs across the U.S. border. So they started paying them off in cocaine.
Mm.
Okay? And that began, then all of a sudden the Mexicans said, hey, wait a minute. There's a lot more money in selling cocaine than in simply transporting cocaine.
Gotcha.
And that's when things really started to go to hell in a handbasket in Mexico, and they've never recovered since then. I mean, it's become the lawlessness in Mexico, which has always had a certain mordida, a certain amount of corruption in the police departments, but nothing like the scale. I mean, when you inject several billion dollars into a criminal enterprise, man, you've got it supercharged. You know, you got a lowrider now that's got nitro in the tank. And not surprisingly, the Mexican the people who are unafraid to take risks stepped into the breach, and they become multi billionaires, and the government cannot touch them.
Well, you know, it's what seems strange to me, and, you know, working in Hollywood as long as you have, maybe you can tell me why, but all throughout the 80s when I was growing up, they had that drug route through the Caribbean and up through Miami, and we got Miami Vice. How come now we don't have, you know, Tijuana Nights or something? I mean, need a good...
I think the story is too gruesome.
Maybe so.
I mean, you know, there was a story the other day about, just a few months ago, about the Mexican drug cartel walked into a bowling alley someplace near Mexico City and bowled a bunch of human heads across the floor.
God.
I mean, that's meant to get your attention. That is meant to tell people, shut up, do not even look at us, or you will be wiped out.
Yeah.
And that message is not only directed at the citizens in the street, it's directed at the government itself.
Yeah.
And
that's too big.
There was a plane crash. They're saying that it was apparently a pilot error that caused this plane crash, but there was a Learjet that went down right in Mexico City that contained three of the top drug officials, criminal crime fighters in Mexico. And while it may not have been sabotage, the Mexican people immediately believed that it was.
Sure.
Because they're in a position right now where they're seeing this stuff happen on a daily basis. And they know they can't trust the government, they can't trust the police, they can't trust the army, they can't trust each other. That's a hell of a situation to wind up in.
Yeah.
If you're a country that's trying to actually, you know, get something done in the 21st century, to have the total disintegration of your criminal justice system right in front of everybody's eyes.
Yeah. Wow. It's far too big a job for Crockett and Tubbs. Absolutely.
Yes, that's true.
This is amazing, you know, and the more I hear about it, it's strange. Maybe it's getting a lot of play in the border states, but I don't think it's getting enough play throughout the country. So Mike Gray, thank you for joining us and giving us a little, more insight on this. Is there anything else or any other, places people could look to get more information on this subject?
Well, I think, the book that I wrote back, although it was printed in the in 1998, I think it was released. But Drug Crazy has a pretty good description of what's going on down there, and it's only gotten worse. But I want to read just one little sentence here from that book. This is I was at a conference in Baltimore, and there was a Colombian High Court judge there named Gomez Hurtado, and I'll never forget what he told us at that conference. This is like 1995, and this is a quote. "Forget about drug deaths and acquisitive crime and addiction and AIDS. All this pales into insignificance before the prospect facing the liberal societies of the West. The income of the drug barons is greater than the American defense budget. With this financial power, they can suborn the institutions of the state, and if the state resists, they can purchase the firepower to outgun it. We are threatened with a return to the Dark Ages." Now, if that isn't a cry to end prohibition, and remember, when we ended alcohol prohibition, we cut the U.S. murder rate in half. Al Capone and all of his boys simply went away to Vegas and opened casinos. You know what I mean?
So
the criminals are not going to go away. You're absolutely right about that. The guys who are now the heavy-duty drug dealers and all that, but they will hopefully go off and run a casino somewhere, you know, because there are plenty of illegal enterprises that do not have this level of cash. The thing that makes the drug war so dangerous for all of us, both law enforcement and private citizens, is the amount of money on the table. It's tax-free. It's enormous. It's unstoppable. And it is just like acid eating at the foundations of our institutions. And if we don't stop this, and the only way you can stop it, there's only one way you can stop it. You cannot stop it by tightening the screws. You have to stop it by stopping prohibition. And the minute you do that, all of this money is gone.
Yeah.
It all immediately goes into taxable legal income controlled by the medical profession, government regulated, government supervised, and under the control of governments everywhere. Right now it's in the hands of the mob.
Yeah, if there's any silver lining to the plummeting economy as of late, maybe it'll be that's the nudge that finally kicks our prohibitionist mindset out the door and gets people to thinking about the money they could make off of that taxation and regulation.
Well, and also the money that we could save. It's $70 billion a year in tax-free... $70 billion a year is what we are spending on law enforcement. I mean, you know, we just dropped $700 billion on a bailout of the banks. And that could be paid for in 10 years by just stopping the drug war.
Absolutely. Well, Mike Gray is the author of Drug Crazy and a screenwriter and an activist and a good friend of the Daily Audio Stash. Thanks again for joining us and giving us your wisdom.
Russ, great. It's a good show, and I appreciate it very much. And stay on the case.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with another one of our cannabis quotes. This is one of my favorites from the author of The Jungle, Upton Sinclair, who wrote, quote, "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it," end quote. No truer words could be said about the drug war. How are we going to get all of these entrenched government bureaucrats whose job depends on the prohibition of marijuana to see the folly in prohibiting marijuana? It's an uphill battle, but we'll be here fighting it day after day at your Normal Daily Audio Stash. For everyone here at Normal, I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow and Wednesday, but we're taking Thanksgiving holiday off. We hope you join us, and until that time, take care of each other, tokers.